And while poverty has been with us since almost the beginning of time, the resources of the world to combat poverty have never been as rich. And the discrepancy between the what could be and ought to be and what is just increases the dreadfulness of the situation. Now, there's no way in which in an hour's time or less we can even begin to touch or do more than just touch a little bit the implications of the topic. And I'm going to bumblebee around a little bit and simply give impressions. They will be impressions that come out of my own personal experience and contact with poverty, particularly in the third world. The opportunity for me to see poverty, to smell it, to hear it, came in conjunction with my assignment to Lutheran General Hospital in Chicago. So those of you who were at the morning session or some sessions last week will know something of what I'm talking about on that. I accepted that job there on condition that I would have one-third of my time free to try to help in the area of poverty medicine. I am, of course, not a medical doctor, but being in contact with large medical resources and a large and very sophisticated hospital, I felt that I should be extremely uncomfortable if I just enjoyed the great excitement of being in a great hospital with all those resources and didn't somehow or another touch the fields of impoverishment in medical resources that I had come in some contact with before. I suppose that my first real sharp, poignant experience or jolt from poverty came in 1945. I was in the United States Navy at the time, and the war had ended. The hostilities were over, but I was still in the Navy. And I was going to go to graduate school in the fall in the Boston area, but this was in January or so. And an admiral of a new fleet, the 20th Fleet, that became the South Atlantic Fleet, and the captain of a new ship that we were putting in commission, had asked me if I would join them for a tour and a cruise down through the South Atlantic, where they were going to introduce this new fleet to the countries that surrounded the South Atlantic. And because I had no job and no way of supporting my family other than Navy income until I went to school, this sounded like a great deal. I didn't exactly look forward to being away from my family for another 6, 8, 9 months, but at least I could put some bread on the table for them. And the cruise itself was a very pleasant one in many ways. We spent a couple of weeks in Bermuda, and we spent a couple of weeks in Trinidad, and we spent a couple of weeks in Recife, Brazil, and a couple of weeks in Rio, and a couple of weeks in Montevideo, Uruguay. And there it blew apart, but that's another story we don't have to go into. But the when we got to Recife, Brazil, the first evening of the first full day that we were there, the officers were invited to a reception put on by the powers that be and the wealthy people of the Recife area. Now, if you are not acquainted with Dom Câmara, the Archbishop of Recife, through his works or through the film that was shown here Sunday morning, how many saw that? All right, good. All right. Recife is his town. He hadn't come there at the time that I'm speaking of now. He was still down in Rio as a young, very young priest. But We were picked up by a whole bunch of long black limousines, and many of which had been brought up by ship just for the occasion from Rio so that they could cart us around in some style. And we were delivered through some gates onto a very large and plush estate. Going in through the gates, or when we approached the gates, there were probably 200 poor people standing outside of the gates, just sort of quietly standing there, knowing that something was going on and hoping, I suppose, that maybe there might be some crumbs that would fall from the lavish tables that had been set inside the gates. At least the smell of food was there, and the sights perhaps also, and they had started to gather. And we got in, and I became ill. The food, I guess, was good enough. It was just that there was so much of it. There was, there were six or seven tent-like structures that had enormous tables. And one of them, for instance, there were six whole roast steers. Another one, there were about 20 or 25 roast sheep stacked up, and then there were tables that had nothing but fruit on them and some that had nothing but fancy breads on them. The number of people at this thing probably numbered, maybe 140, because there aren't that many wealthy people in Recife. And this included about 70 people from our ship. So these were the few of the wealthy ones. We couldn't have eaten that in 6 months. This was done for some kind of show. I stayed around for a little while, but it was too much to contrast this with the poverty that I'd already seen in Recife and in other places in Latin America. But so I went to the skipper, my captain, and said, would you understand if I tell you this is too much for me and I'd like to ask for a car so I can go back to the ship? And he said, no, Padre, I thoroughly understand. I'd do it myself, except it'll become a political incident if I walked out on this. I invited him to make it a political incident, but he, because he thought I was kidding, and he just backed away from it, but he would have liked to have joined me. We got down to the gate, but by the time we got there, there were four or five other officers that had decided that they had had it, and they wanted no part of this horrible vulgarity. So they had crowded into the car also. When we got to the gate, we saw that there was a different situation at the gate. The gates were closed. There were probably 150 soldiers with machine guns and a crowd of maybe 1,000 poor and starving. The soldiers prodded with bayonets on their Tommy guns and drove the crowd back until finally there was enough room for this long, black, shiny limousine to drive through. And there was a shout, and the gates opened, a shout from the soldiers and ones in command, and cars started to move forward. It just lurched forward, but directly ahead of us in the road was a man lying apparently unconscious. It turned out that he was unconscious. And I screamed at the driver and told him to stop because it seemed to me he hadn't seen him. And as soon as he stopped, I did what I think any of us would have done. I jumped out and went up there to see if there was any way to help this man. And I got down on my knees alongside of him and tried to find a pulse. It was there, but weak. Listened for his heart by putting my head down on his chest, and the heart was beating, but faintly. And I asked some of the people who were standing around if they would help, and we got our hands underneath him and took him off to the side of the road. And I got back in the car, and we drove on, at which I found that my fellow officers and the driver were hardly my friends anymore because they had thought this could be a very dangerous situation. Sometimes it pays to be dumb and not think through the implications. It could have been a dangerous situation. A mob could easily have resented the guy standing out there in a bright, shiny, white uniform with brass buttons all shined up and already overweight, even in those days. The next morning, I was aboard ship and still suffering from the experience of the day before, this contrast of wealth and poverty, the enormous suffering of the peoples in Brazil. And a sailor came to my room and said that there was a priest on deck and he'd like to talk to me. So I asked that he be brought down, and I met him in the wardroom, which is sort of a dining room and also a, sort of a parlor for the officers. And here was a dusty, little, skinny priest who, well, he was just dirty. And he came in, introduced himself very politely. He could barely speak English, but enough so I could understand. And I'd made the mistake before going to Brazil of thinking this was a Spanish-speaking country, and I'd boned up on Spanish. Turns out it's a Portuguese-speaking place, so I was no help at all in the conversation. And he asked if, while we were in port, if he could be of any help. Could he come aboard to hear confessions or have a priest come and have a priest come to say Mass? Well, we had a lot of Catholic fellows aboard the ship, and of course I was delighted then to accept his invitation. And then there was something about this man that got at me. He was dirty, he was skinny, he was a very, very unimpressive kind of a guy. But his eyes were interesting, and his manner was humble and courteous. I walked back up, not quite willing to let him go, and walked back up to the quarterdeck when he was going to go off the ship. And just as we were leaving the ship, he said, "I saw you at the gate yesterday." 20 years later, I ran across this man in another country. Most of the years he has been running for his life. One government after another seeking to imprison him, if not assassinate him. He's been hidden by one bishop or archbishop after another while he hides because he has stood alongside of the poor and fought for land reforms. And all of these things, of course, are very threatening to those 50 or so wealthy people in Recife who loaded the table so richly, because the rich absolutely need the poor for their survival as rich. So he was threatening them by standing with the poor. Now, he is by no means alone. When I met him many years later, he had simply seen that I was going to be in the town in the country that he was now hiding in. And he came under the protection of an archbishop and his staff just to say hello again. No more than 20 minutes of a man who certainly did a lot to change my life. So when I went to Lutheran General Hospital, I said I want 1/3 of my time to at least sit with some people and try to relate the rich resources that we have in health care in the United States to the impoverished in wherever. So in 1964 and 65, I spent a year in Africa and Southeast Asia at little hospitals and doing some thinking and consultations that later resulted in some rural public health types of efforts as over against big hospital kinds of efforts in these countries. For instance, in Tanzania, there's a large hospital that had been built mostly with European Christian money, a place called Kilimanjaro Christian Medical Center. Some of you have heard of it. It's a magnificent hospital. Incidentally, on the day that it was dedicated, President Nyerere accepted it as a gift to the Tanzanian nation and took it away from the Good Samaritan Society that had built it. Well, that isn't all that bad because they got a hospital. You know, what are we in there for? You know, it's like when they closed up Radio Voice of the Gospel in Ethiopia. Magnificent, one of the most powerful radio stations in the whole world. And when it closed, they sang the doxology, had a great celebrating service, and said, thank God, you know, for 15 years or whatever of opportunity to build this station and to use it and to spread the message through it. That same spirit was in the minds of most people at the dedication when Nyerere took the hospital. Well, I'm kind of glad in a way that he did. After 2 years, they decided that they couldn't quite operate it the way it ought to be run, and they invited back, and now has been a rather fine cooperative relationship between the Tanzanian government and health ministry and the Good Samaritan Society. But at any rate, this disturbed me quite a bit, because if you put in $3 million into a hospital and locate it on a piece of ground, any place in Africa, it means that you have concentrated unusual resources that will be available to a very few people, because they can't travel all that far. The means of transportation, they're not going to fly into that hospital. The people come walking, or sometimes in wheelbarrows, and sometimes on the buses that sometimes run, and they come with their families, and they come with firewood, and they come with some goats, and they, you know, because there's no central kitchens. Well, there is at Kilimanjaro, but in most of these hospitals there are no central kitchens. The family has to bring the food, even, and take care, do all the nursing care, for instance, for the patients in many of the bush hospitals. Well, at any rate, it bothered me a little bit. While I was happy to see this hospital go up, it seemed to me that there was another approach that ought to be at least demonstrated. So we got the cooperation of the Tanzanian government, of the Lutheran Church of the Northern Diocese in Tanzania, and of Lutheran General Hospital in Chicago, and we started a program of an under five clinic, because we had found in doing a little survey that 51% of all babies or all children died before they were 5 years old. Now, that's a rather typical figure around the world, in the third world, by the way. That is not an unusual percentage. Mothers, half of your babies would die if you lived in those countries before they were five. And they'd die of stupid, silly little diseases like measles or something like that. Mostly because the malnutrition is so bad, it leaves people weak and wide open to anything. So we designed a little program that is not hard to put together. We got the government to provide some student nurses. They wouldn't provide graduate nurses, but some student nurses, and we'll give them a little bush hospital experience as part of their training. And then we hired and paid for a medical assistant. That's a doctor type, is a guy who's had no medical school, but 2 years of training in a hospital under expatriate doctors, under European or American doctors. And these guys carry the burden of third world medicine. And they do a magnificent job. But anyway, we hired one of those fellows. His salary was $2,200 a year. So he's not a very expensive man. His salary and his expenses, by the way. We bought a Toyota Land Rover vehicle for transportation and turned it over to a guy that was a very careful man. He maintained that vehicle, and 5 years later, it looked like it was still new. And on African roads, that's a remarkable thing. But we told him, take it home with you every night. Don't let it out of your sight. Treat it as though it were yours, and have it ready to go in the morning. And he kept that thing lubricated and maintained just beautifully. But at any rate, we then invited the mothers to bring their children, under five, to the clinic. This was not in a hospital. This was out under the palm trees someplace, or where there was some little remains of some sort of a school or whatever, where they could run a clinic. There we had an African who had been trained to give some talks on sanitation and nutrition and disease prevention, public health kind of lectures. We put out a little brochure that the Africans thought was uproariously funny, because we showed, for instance, we wanted to show that you want to clean up your water so that you don't have mosquitoes, because mosquitoes can kill your babies. And we showed a baby with a mosquito on its head. Now, the artist had made the mosquito of enough size so that it could be seen and recognized. Now, this is a small brochure, and the baby's head couldn't be very big, and the mosquito is, you know, well, that couldn't be. So the mosquito was enlarged so you could recognize it as a mosquito standing on its head, you know, like the Anopheles mosquito does. And the African said, poor, poor American. To have mosquitoes that big, because see, they saw these as about 2 feet long, you know, like sometimes we think ours are. Every baby that came was given a card in a plastic envelope. I have seen any number of those health records that carried through 5 whole years. A newborn brought to the clinic in the first year we operated, and the health record still intact and clean and decent and up to date at the end of 5 years, and I have never seen anything like that for an American kid. His weight was charted every month, a record of all inoculations and examinations given to him. The doctor would see every child and look. But he looked for only a few things. He didn't look to find out if the kid's liver was in good shape. You know, he had no way to look for it. He couldn't run him through a fancy computerized analyzer, you know, to find out these things. They had no SMA-12s or 21s or whatever these many-channel analyzing things that we have in most hospitals today, and they certainly had no CAT scans. But what he would do was look at the hair. Is the hair red? If the hair was red, he passed them over and put them into a line where he would be, he and his mother, or the child and his mother, would be invited then to attend or to go to a place that we called NURU, which was short for Nutritional Rehabilitation Center. This was not in the hospital, and we didn't allow doctors and nurses to go to it. Well, occasionally we'd sneak one in when it was dark. But we didn't want the Africans to see doctors and nurses there and to assume that this is some of the magic of Western medicine, because it's so easy to cure the terrible disease that was represented by that red hair. The red hair meant protein deficiency in the brain, among and the rest of the body also, and also in the hair. And the hair turns red, so it's easy to spot. You can see it a block away. Now, if a kid has this disease called kwashiorkor, and I'll bet most of you have never heard of it, but kwashiorkor is a dreadful disease, protein deficiency in the first year of life, usually, it's in the first year of life, and it means that if the kid lives at all, but if this is a serious predicament he's in, that he's going to be retarded, and there are literally millions of retarded Africans simply because nobody got there in time with a little protein. And it takes remarkably little. We take the mother and her child down and show them the garden and say, these rows are yours. There were vegetables in there that were high protein vegetables. Showed her how to plant. When she picked a vegetable, she had to plant the vegetable so that there'd be a rotation of good, fresh vegetable, a replacement. showed her how to take them in and keep them until she cooked them. Showed her how to cook them the right way for maximum nutritional benefit. Showed her how to puree or whatever was necessary for the age of the child and the physical condition of the child so the child could swallow and ingest this. And it was just like a miracle to see the hair starting to turn black instead of this horrible shade of red. Now, normally, red hair is very attractive, but not in Africa. Not in Africa. The mortality rate on the slopes of Mount Kilimanjaro, where we established 20 of these one-day-a-month clinics, in that target population, there were 10,000 kids that were in that program. The mortality rate in that program dropped from 51% to 26% in 5 years. Now, that's not very good. It meant that 26% of all the babies were still dying, and most of them needlessly. But it did mean that 25% of them lived, that otherwise probably would have died. We said when we entered the thing that we would stay there 5 years and get out. We think that's an important principle. When we got out, the Tanzanian Ministry of Health decided to establish 50 programs similar to this one throughout the country. They're not working very well, but they are doing something. At Klabisa, up in Zululand, at a hospital, I came in at about 4 o'clock one afternoon and sitting down in the doctor's home to have dinner. And just as we sat down, a nurse came in and said, "You can forget it. Come on down, we have to do surgeries," she said to the doctor. And the doctor said, "Can't wait." And he had just driven down to Durban to pick me up, and he was tired. And she said, "No, this cannot wait." And he said, "Well, we don't have three doctors. South African law says you have to have three doctors in surgery, three MDs, or you can't operate." They only had two. But there was a medical student there. So there was an ethical problem. Do we defy the laws of the land and go ahead and operate to save the life of this woman in defiance of the law? Somebody would go to jail in all probability if the woman died. I can show you records of doctors that have spent months or at least weeks in jail after operating when there were not three MDs in surgery. Now, the Africans can't afford this. The mission hospitals couldn't afford to have three doctors around in the place for surgery. The doctor turned to me and said, "Okay, you came here to see what it's like. Come on." And I stood in surgery and watched them do a cesarean section on a woman who had had two cesarean sections previously. There was too much scar tissue. She bled like crazy. She was losing fluid so rapidly that they poured in everything they had except that evening's dishwater to try to keep up some pressure in those collapsing veins. And finally, it looked like this very healthy little baby that was snatched out of this almost tomb was going to make it. And then it looked like maybe the mother might, because the pulse started to come back and the heartbeat, and she started to color up a little bit the way she ought to, instead of this grayish cast that had come across her face. And we went back to the doctor's home and were sitting there, and they were sort of welcoming us a little bit. And then the nurse came back and said, "You better come back again. She's bleeding badly." So they had to open her up another time, and it was a horrible, horrible thing to watch. But there's something awfully tough about these people that have been deprived so much. And through some miracle, mostly that of love and the skill of doctors that were willing to go to jail to save the life, she recovered. My wife and I were there for about 3 or 4 weeks at that particular hospital. And the morning we were going to leave, we went down to the ward where this mother was, and She was sitting on the edge of the bed then chuckling away and laughing with a bunch of women who were sitting around. She was doing very well, and her baby was doing very well. And Gertrude and I had to run to get out of there, because sometimes the tears of joy choke you up just as much as those of sadness. Miracle. But why should she have to go through this business? They had to chase down the next day for 50 miles to try to find two more pints of blood. Then it was the wrong type when it got back there, and they couldn't use it. There's a little Indian town near the University of Tirupati in India. There's a big shrine up on the hill, Tirupati, if any of you have known this one. It's one of the wealthiest Hindu shrines in India. The dome of the temple is not plated, it's solid gold. And it's been accumulating over the many, many years, centuries perhaps. Everybody that comes in to Tirupati Shrine gets their hair clipped off. You've seen some of these Indian holy men walking around with hair hanging down to their knees, you know, lots of hair. They do that so they can make a big offering, because when they finally get to the shrine, all this hair is given then to the gods and to Vishnu. And they... So this is a bigger offering. It isn't just that they like a long hairstyle. But everybody gets shaved when they go in there, and the hair is used, and the Indian hair has an unusual tensile strength, so it has some commercial value, or at least used to, and that's one of the reasons that this hair is clipped this way. But in a little town, just a ball, 10 miles from Tirupati, where they had decided not to put any more gold into the temple now, but they had decided to build a university instead, and the fastest growing university I've ever seen was built right at the foot of the shrine down below the hill in the town of Tirupati. But 10 or 12 miles away was a very impoverished little village. And I stood there while the medical team was doing blood testing in the place. That's all they were there for, was just doing blood tests. And it was noon before they found a blood that measured 6 grams of hemoglobin. Now, if there are any nurses or doctors in the crowd, they'll know that's a little bit startling. There were people there who were alive and walking around with 2.5 grams. Something like 14 is normal. An American, anybody in this room would be very ill with 8. You'd be in a hospital. But there's a sort of adaptation that takes place when you've been poor long enough and starved long enough. So somehow or another you can hang on and stay alive. I saw a cesarean section done on a woman with 3 grams of hemoglobin. And she lived. Well, they'd never even attempted, I think, in this country. Let's jump to Central America, where I spent more time than I did in the other places. Hurricane Fifi, some of you remember back 12, I don't know how many years, I've forgotten all that stuff. I'm just senile enough so I can't remember whether it was last year or 18 years ago, but somewhere in there Hurricane Fifi went through Honduras. And it left a horrible trail of, you know, floods. The winds didn't do much damage, but floods as washed away the sides of the mountains, and they came roaring down and washed away houses and towns, and it was a mess. And I was sleeping comfortably in my Park Ridge, Illinois home when the telephone rang at 2 o'clock in the morning, and a Spanish-accented voice was on the other end, and the man finally got my attention enough by way of a radio patch through a phone to realize that this was my good friend, a doctor from Costa Rica that I had been associating with for quite some time. And he said, "Fritz, we need some help, and we need it right away. We need it by tomorrow. We need 1,000 scalp vein sets." Scalp vein sets are tiny, tiny little needles. Just tiny, tiny things with little capillary tubes that they put in babies' heads to feed them through veins in the head. Because you don't want babies thrashing around like this. How can you? You know. So they, kwashiorkor kids, for instance, if they're in very bad shape and they have to feed them, they put a plaster skull cap on them. That is, they put a cast on the top of the head with these vein, scalp vein things going into that, and they feed them through that. And I saw 46 of those kids in one hospital in Durban, in one pediatrics ward at one time. Were those. Well, this fellow said he needed all that, and he needed a lot of other stuff. Bandages, all kinds of things. So he said, "And we need them right away." So I said, "All right, we'll go to work on it." He said, "Now, what you do is have the pilot of the plane that's going to deliver them to El Progreso, to San Pedro Sula in Honduras, tell him that the alcalde will pick them up." The alcalde is the mayor of this town, a pretty good-sized town of San Pedro del Sula. I called my good friend Ernie Holman and said, "Ernie, for goodness sakes, get the airplanes lined up so we can get this stuff transported down." I went over to the supply, central supply at the hospital and stole the place blind. Got 1,000 scalp vein sets and all the other stuff that they wanted. The poor guy who was on night duty in that place was having a fit, but he said, "All right, Dr. Lewiston, if you want, you know, you sign for it though, because I don't want to face anybody in the morning with all of this." And so I was glad to sign for it. And we walked out of there with case after case after case of stuff. And Ernie Holman was outside of the door when they got it all assembled, and he dashed it to the airport. And he said, "I've got a Delta Airline pilot who's going to rush it down for us, and it will be transferred at Miami onto one of the South American airline planes. And this pilot from Delta will carry it over personally and make sure that it gets aboard the plane for down there and all the instructions." So before noon, it was in a little town of El Progreso that had just been almost wiped out by this flood, where disease was running crazy. Babies were dying. It was a horrible, horrible, horrible mess. I sat one night and watched 8 little babies die during the night. It's because there wasn't enough of anything, and too late. That was just a couple of weeks later. But at any rate, when it was all over down there, when the floodwaters receded and these poor people who had suffered enough now went back to their normal suffering and not the unusual suffering. A doctor came up to me. He was from up in the hills someplace. He was running a mission hospital up in the hills. He was Honduran, a very fine Christian man who had started a hospital, and he had started a system of running a hospital that he thought would work, and he was willing to leave his Pine Forest Hospital, a kind of a Holden Village kind of location up in the hills, and come down into this dirty, dusty, fly-ridden, disease-ridden floodplain area and put up a new hospital if he could find a hospital. But he had to find a hospital. I asked him how in the world he could maintain it once he got it, because he don't like to make promises to people about building a hospital for them, even if you can do it, and then find you can't man it and staff it and maintain it forever. And he said, "Don't worry about that part. We've got that all taken care of. How do you do that?" "Oh," he said, "I'll use the same system we used up there." "Well, what's that?" "Well," he said, "we just categorize all the patients, and we make 2 private rooms in the hospital with air conditioning. And that's for people who can come into the hospital, pay $250, and we'll give them a room and board for 1 week. But then, of course, they have to pay for their drugs and for surgery and for anything we do for them. But for 1 week, they can stay in this place for $250. Then, he said, we have 4 rooms that are semi-private rooms. And the people that come to those semi-private rooms also get an air conditioner. It's a smaller air conditioner, but it's an air conditioner. There's but two patients to a room, and they pay $125, not $250, but they can stay 2 weeks. Well, I thought he had something backwards here, but I let it go for the moment. Then he said, then we have two big wards, one for 20 women, one for 20 men. And these people must bring $50 in their hand and hand it to me, and they get, as long as they need in the hospital, surgery, medicine, anything they need, but they must have $50 when they come. Well, I said, this is just reverse of good economics. I can't understand this one at all. You know, the more you get, the less you pay. And he said, that's the idea. Yeah. You know, the people that can pay $250, they can go some other place and get it. You know, they can fly out of here and go to some other place. They could even conceivably go to Puerto Rico or to the United States or someplace. But I make enough money off those private rooms and those semi-private rooms to take care of the $50 people. Then I said, all right, what do you do with all the rest then that can't have $50 when they come? And then the man's shoulders sagged, and he spoke in a voice I could hardly hear, and he said, I just have to let them go. Well, we managed to get to the hospital. It wasn't all that much of a task. And the thing has been running fine. But every day, the hardcore poor are turned away. Now, if you are inclined to judge him, back off just a moment. If he accepted the poorest free, he may be able to keep that hospital running for 2 months, maybe even for 6 months. And then it would go out of existence. This way, at least, it keeps going. I want the phyllo. First time I saw it was the stinkiest, dirtiest place I had ever seen in my life. I vomited 3 times in the first hour I was there. Now, you're not going to like me very well in the next few minutes, but I was going to say that the thing that made me vomit was human excrement. That word doesn't smell like what I smelled and walked in. It was shit. There wasn't, for 840 some people, there wasn't one single lavatory. There was a garden hose supplying water from up on the hill, and some people that said, okay, let them tap into this. One garden hose for 840 people. And the kids would come out and urinate all over the street. Well, the adults would just go behind their little shack. Nobody had a house. They lived in old boxes, some old culverts that they'd stolen someplace. Anything that could get a little shelter from the rain. Every girl in that village was a prostitute if she was 12 years old or over. And the mothers would stand and shoo them out. At about 4:30, 5 o'clock every afternoon, you'd see the mothers chasing their little girls out to go out and make some money. Now, these aren't bad mothers. These are good mothers. They're good mothers. And they love their kids just as much as I love my Sue that I talked about this morning. But somehow or another, when it really comes down to it, you eat or you die, don't you? Every little boy in the place, from about 4 years old and on, was a thief, and the kids under 8 were the best of all because nobody suspected them, they thought. They could sneak through windows and they could go up and con people more easily than the older ones. They'd shoo away the teenage kids. So the adolescent girls and the child boys were the ones that provided the food for the village. No jobs. They couldn't buy a job. There are literally hundreds of people, by the way, in San Jose, Costa Rica, and in every town all over the country, living under bridges, and they are the upper middle class of the impoverished, simply because they got a cement roof over their head where the bridge goes over the river. And they have a sanitation system built in because the water goes down. Awantafilo means hold your hunger. That's literal translation. Hold your hunger. Some politician came along and he was stopping outside of the Awantafilo, this shack town, suburb of kind of San Jose. And he stood on his truck with a sound outfit and he was talking about how if they vote for him, he'd see to it that their kids had plenty to eat. And they said, but our kids are hungry today. You vote for me and I'll provide good schools for their children. They'll learn how to make their living. But our kids are dying today. And they kept shouting back at him. And the guy lost his cool. And he says, I want the filo. And drove off. I want the filo. Hold your hunger. Live with it. Stuff it. And these people took that as the name of their village. The village where you hold your hunger. Mireia Baltadano. Those parents were, or his father was a pastor in León, I think it is, in Nicaragua. One of the places where the most vicious fighting took place, or some of the most vicious fighting in the Nicaraguan Revolution a couple years ago took place. But she was studying at the University of Costa Rica in San Jose. And as part of her training, she came up and lived with us for a year in Park Ridge to get some more training, and also because she was a very remarkable gal. Mireia is a communist and belonged to a communist cell in the university. Now, will you listen carefully to me? It's very important, that you listen carefully and understand what I'm saying. Mireia was a communist, and she belonged to a cell within the University of Communists. Every Saturday morning, this group met at 4 o'clock in the morning for Bible study and for prayer before starting down into the barrios, into the worst of the slum areas, where they did all kinds of jobs in the name of Jesus Christ for the people in the barrios. Maria's job was to teach girls how to become stenographers and typists. But she had discovered long since, she was 7 years in the university, wasn't through yet because she could only go part-time because of all this work that she was doing in the barrios, and because of shortage of money. She had to teach girls how to bathe and keep clean, because you can't get a job if you're dirty. Huh? What office is going to have you? She had to teach them how to use decent, proper language instead of the four-letter words of the barrios, because you can't get a job unless you know the language and use it properly. Huh? She had to teach them how to make clothes because they didn't have any money to buy them, but they tried to scrounge up stuff so that they could make their clothes. And it took 8 years to make a secretary. So she had to start when they were very young. Said it took her about 6 months to teach them shorthand and typing. The rest of the time were all those things about how you live. Then Mireia went to Nicaragua and the fighting broke out because her father and her mother were there. And we haven't heard from her since. But I'm sure she picked up a gun and fought with the rebels. If I hadn't been such a chicken, I would have joined her. When our news media start talking about these places, they talk in terms of rebels and leftists and communists, and we hear something quite evil. Don't be so ready to jump into that trap. For whatever it's worth, and just to shock, and because I've run out of time, surely. If I were, and I mean this, if I were living as a Christian in Central America, I would be a leftist, I would be a rebel, I probably would be a communist. And I would try to join some group at the university or wherever to get on my knees every Saturday morning for Bible study and prayer, and then go in the name of Jesus down there to try to give some food to those who are dying, or teach them how to make a living, or make it unnecessary for little 12-year-old girls to be shooed out by their mothers so they can earn their living as prostitutes on the streets of San Jose. Now, I said that the rich absolutely need the poor, and that means you have to have strong governments to make sure that there are no rebellions. And United States arms are the chief resource for the strong governments of Central America. Pray.